This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the aftermath of the South Carolina primary, Andrew Shane, writing in Columbia's The State newspaper, said, in a state where religion and civility matter, Donald Trump, the New York billionaire, admitted he never has asked God for forgiveness, called rivals liars and idiots, and used a vulgarity during a rally. Last week, even the Pope characterized Donald Trump for being unchristian with his support for a wall across our southern border with Mexico. And yet, Mr. Trump won Saturday among evangelical voters who make up more than two-thirds of the South Carolina GOP electorate. Why are southern Christians getting behind a brash northerner? How will the evangelical vote play out beyond South Carolina? And what impact might some big names on the religious right who are working to mobilize conservative Christians have on the election? We talked that over this hour with Dr. Scott Huffman, professor of political science at Winthrop University and director of the Winthrop Poll Initiative. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Tim Funk is the faith and values reporter who is also now covering politics for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Dr. Laura Olson joins us by phone from Clemson University, where she is a professor of political science. Dr. Olson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
Before we strictly talk about evangelical voters, let's talk about what happened on Saturday in South Carolina. Jeb Bush dropped out of the race. Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio are neck and neck for second. Donald Trump trumped the field. Aside from the influence of evangelical voters, what led to that victory? Let me start with Dr. Olson.
Well, we saw a record turnout, which was one thing. Of course, this is what we would call a high-stimulus election, which drives turnout up. Lots and lots of media coverage of it. Lots of candidates, obviously, came to visit the state. And so we saw lots and lots of people turn out. How does that help explain the result? Typically, the best predictors of turnout are education, income, and age. And so if we see that turnout is high, what that suggests is that there are people who maybe span the categories of education, income, and age. And at least in the case of the first two, education and income, what we're seeing in all kinds of poll data is that Trump is doing especially well among people who are working class, people who are not as well educated. And so the turnout of those folks, in my view, is really what drove his victory.
What's your take, Dr. Huffman?
Well, I agree. And those folks were channeling this anger, and they were putting it on to Donald Trump as their champion. I actually think we've had this coming in South Carolina since 2010. If you look back to the 2010 Republican primary, you had four white male establishment candidates, one of whom was absolutely going to be the Republican nominee and the next governor. And you had this unknown legislator named Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley was just dead last in all the polls. Then she got the endorsement of Sarah Palin. The Tea Party picked her up and lifted her. She then surged ahead in all the polls, got to a runoff in the primary, and was pushed by the Tea Party folks into the governor's mansion. And that Tea Party wave in South Carolina was the first inkling of anger that conservative white voters had against the GOP establishment. And, you know, her race at that point did not matter. It didn't matter that she was slightly brown. What mattered was she was deeply red. And so the anger against the establishment helped surge that Tea Party push. And then in 2012, everybody said, South Carolina got it wrong because we voted for Newt Gingrich, not Mitt Romney, who eventually got it. It was the first time we had ever voted for someone who didn't go on to get the nomination. I'm now thinking that was the canary in the coal mine for the national GOP. Again, the anger that we saw building and coalesce behind a Tea Party candidate in 10, coalesced behind the insurgent anti-establishment candidate in 2012. And in fact, if you look, the whole cycle in South Carolina in 2012 was the steadiest was Mitt Romney in the polling, and the only person beating him was the insurgent anti-Mitt Romney candidate of that week. And so it went from Bachman to Santorum to, you know, Herman Cain, and peaked with Newt Gingrich after his performance bashing the media and the establishment in a debate. And now we've seen that same anger against the Republican establishment happen nationwide. So basically the lesson from South Carolina in 2012 was not picked up on by the national party, and we're seeing Trump kind of be the emblem of that anger.
I have to ask what the anger is about, particularly the anger with the Republican establishment, because they have been relatively successful at obstructing a lot of what President Obama says he'd like to do or wanted to do. Why are they angry?
They haven't been effective. They haven't rolled back what Obama's done. And plus, they see the Supreme Court case upholding the same-sex marriage as popular culture pushing against their beliefs.
But
they
the Supreme
see
Court is not Republican. It's supposedly nonpartisan.
But
it's the other branch
of government. The Republicans in power have not stood up for him. Basically, it's the same type of argument, and we'll get into this later, that evangelicals have often not turned out in poll in elections in decades past because they felt used. They felt pandered to and then not have their values upheld. The same with Republican voters who feel that they're pandered to for their conservative votes and then ignored till the next election cycle.
Prior to the primary, Dr. Olson, you pointed out that evangelicals in much larger numbers than you might ordinarily expect are supporting Donald Trump. You are right. You were right about that. Why? What is it about Donald Trump that they find attractive?
Well, I want to first echo something that Scott said, which is that this anger piece is a big factor in what's going on here. And the anger, I think, let me address that first before we talk about what about Trump is so appealing, because they're connected, of course. The anger, in part, among evangelicals, of course, is this sort of, we feel pandered to, we feel that we've lined up behind, whichever candidate, and then, where are the morally conservative policy outcomes? So there's that piece, but there's, I think, an even deeper, more profound piece that that connects to class, which is rendering evangelical identity less important than class identity in this case. This feeling, I think, and we see it too among many Bernie Sanders supporters on the other side, this feeling that the so-called establishment doesn't work for me, right? I didn't get bailed out in 2008. There are other people, sort of faceless, unknown people out there who get advantages in our system, and I, the ordinary working class white person in this case, do not. And so it's this kind of really deep kind of palpable yet difficult to label anger. Now, why does Trump appeal to people who feel that anger? One thing that folks have found in early studies of this election year, and we really don't know anything in a very sophisticated way yet, but there's a really influential theory right now in social psychology called moral foundations theory, which posits that we have 5 or 6 or maybe more sort of very basic general orientations toward the world and what we think is good and what we think is bad. And this sort of preliminary study that some folks have done suggests that people who support Trump tend to be very high in their degree, in the degree to which they believe that obedience is important, obedience of authority figures, and also a little bit low on compassion for others. And so if you're low on compassion for others and you feel disenchanted with your own lot in life right now, and then you also feel like being obedient to strong authority figures is important, Donald Trump embodies that, right? Donald Trump is someone who asserts himself with, tremendous, really, many would say, overbearing self-confidence, this sense that, well, I am better than the rest of the candidates, I know what's best, I am going to, quote-unquote, make America great again, and I am going to speak to ordinary people like you, maybe veterans, maybe people who haven't been able to find adequate work, and we're going to stick it to China, and we're going to stick it to Mexico, and this sort of thing, and we're going to assert ourselves. And that kind of commands this leader-follower kind of model, I think, in a lot of people's minds.
Evangelicals. Let's talk about them for a second. Tim Funk, evangelicals may not read these subversive comic strip pages in your newspaper, but yesterday in Doonesbury, Did you read it? Gary Trudeau's cartoon. A minister was musing about this. The minister says, so can you explain, he's sitting at a kitchen table with two other characters. So can you explain Trump's evangelical supporters to me? I mean, what are they thinking? Trump's a twice divorced, non-church going, ex-casino operator, the living embodiment of the seven deadly sins. Pride, greed, heck, those are just our care brand values, core brand values. Envy, he attacks his betters every day. Lust, he's a womanizer who says he wants to date his own daughter. Gluttony, he's all about bloat. Wrath, no one is angrier. I mean, when you think about it, is there any significant difference between Trump and the devil himself? Now, those comments are from Doonesbury, not me. So in a race where there are genuine evangelicals running, Ted Cruz, how did Cruz become in third where 50% of the voters are churchgoers and when many of the things that Trudeau asserts about Trump are true?
Well, you know, I was at the Trump rally Saturday night in Spartanburg, and I talked to a lot of his supporters, and I've also talked to pastors and others, and they've said, you know, we're angry because we've supported people like George Bush, who are very evangelical, and what has it gotten us? We want to support a guy who's going to be a strong leader, who's going to go in there and just break everything up. He's obviously successful. Look at his business career. One pastor told me he is our secular vehicle for change.
So this is a new strategy.
Well, no, I think 4 years ago they voted for Newt Gingrich in South Carolina, who had also been divorced twice, and because I think they feel like, well, we tried voting for people who sound like us, who go to church like us, but we still have same-sex marriage, we still have Planned Parenthood, we still have Muslims, we still have immigrants coming. I think these are all issues that concern them, and they feel like nothing's being done. One political scientist told me a lot of evangelicals feel lost in their own country because they feel like the culture is slipping away from them. Mm-hmm. They used to be influential and not anymore. So I think they want a change, and I think they feel like, look, this guy has a proven record. Whatever you think of him, he has a proven record as a businessman. He's strong, spoken, and he can get things done. Whether he really can, we'll see.
I'm not sure who to ask this question of, but is there a difference between white evangelicals, who probably were the greatest number of participants in the Republican South Carolina primary, and African-American, black evangelicals who will participate next Saturday?
Well, you could call both of them evangelicals, frankly. I mean, that's a fairly broad term.
But is there a difference in their outlook?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think both of them look to the Bible. They're both theologically conservative, you know, the black churches and the white evangelical churches, but they vote very differently. I think in the black churches, and you're going to see Bernie Sanders, I think he was at a black church yesterday in South Carolina. You're going to see Hillary Clinton, because African-American Christians tend to vote Democratic. They have since John F. Kennedy was president. And I think they are more interested in social issues, poverty, jobs, things like that, where I think a lot of white evangelical churches, you'll hear a lot of talk about same-sex marriage and abortion and Planned Parenthood and Christians getting beheaded overseas and what are we going to do about it and things like that. So
the basic thing to really note here, I think, is that in the case of race, and to a degree, ethnicity, but certainly race, supersedes religion. And so what you have is African-American evangelicals, and most African-American Christians are, in fact, evangelicals, using a strict definition of the term, would see eye to eye on many moral issues, as we just heard, with white evangelicals and with Latino evangelicals. But
I have to stop you there because we have to go to a break, Dr. Olson. I'm sorry about that. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm Horak Tally, helping individuals and businesses find sharp solutions to their legal needs for more than 80 years. Details at HorakTally.com. And Culture and Heritage Museums hosting Swimming in Dark Waters, Other Voices of the African American Experience with Rhiannon Giddens this Saturday at the McKelvey Center. Tickets at chmuseums.org/Southern Sound Series. Well, this weekend's Academy Awards is looming large. Once again, it's come under fire for the lack of diversity among the nominees. For the second year in a row, every actor nominee is white. We talk about that and the backlash from actors vowing to boycott the Oscars with Eric Fraser, who wrote an op-ed piece in The Observer about this. And we hash out the remaining nominees with two of Charlotte's film critics, Matt Brunson and Sean O'Connell. That's all tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Republican primary voters go to the polls in South Carolina while Democrats vote in the Nevada caucuses. Analysis of the results and what they mean for the presidential candidates heading into Super Tuesday.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the influence of evangelicals in the South Carolina primary and into the national election going forward with Dr. Scott Huffman, professor of political science and director of the Winthrop Poll at Winthrop University. Tim Funk is the faith and values reporter and a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Dr. Laura Olson is professor of political science in Clemson University, who I had to rudely interrupt just a moment ago as we were talking about the difference between white evangelicals in South Carolina and black evangelicals. And you were about to make a point, and I had to get in the way of you. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no worries whatsoever. I'm sorry. I'm on the phone, so I can't see the time when we're coming up to break. But let me just quickly finish that point. In American politics, race and the social meaning of race for people who are black is far more important than religious identity. And so African Americans, probably 90% of the time, are going to be Democratic and are not going to be considering Republican candidates just right out of the box. So that's the only thing to sort of say about that.
But Ted Cruz is an evangelical. He his father is a minister. He speaks the language of evangelical Christians. He campaigned in the state on the stump. He prayed. He spoke about Jesus. Why is this not resonating over the brash, rude, abrasive, sometimes cursing behavior of Donald Trump?
I think it does resonate with certain evangelical Christians. I would say that
he's also not well-liked in Congress, which is a point in his favor, it would seem to me, among a lot of Republican voters.
Well, he has really reached out to the evangelical leadership, and I think he has a lot of support among those leaders, plus those churchgoers who really heavily identify with church, who are the ones that go Sunday and Wednesday. But the evangelical, the white evangelical vote is not a monolith. It's divided. I think Dr. Olson put her finger on it. I mean, the blue-collar evangelicals, like blue-collar voters generally in South Carolina, really were attracted to Donald Trump. And I think, again, they feel like he's giving a very populist message. And I think that really appeals to them. They care about jobs. They care about immigration. They care about these issues. And they feel like, the biggest applause Saturday night at the rally was he said, "Yes, we're going to build a wall." And then he cupped his ear and he said, and who's going to pay for it?" And they all yelled, "Mexico." So, I mean, that's not per se a religious issue, but of course that brought the Pope in because there are passages in the Bible say, "Welcome the stranger." And, when I was hungry, you fed me. And when I was a stranger, you welcomed me. So I think there's no
so
one Christian
are, so
vote.
So those are Christian principles. Why are they willing to turn their head away from those principles?
Well, let's explain how we slice and dice evangelicals. Okay, so first off, we imagine this huge pool of evangelicals in South Carolina. But who are we actually talking about? We're talking about a subset who are highly politicized because you have to be very political minded to show up for a primary, not even a general election, a primary election in the first place. So we're actually talking about first people who are screened as likely participants in the Republican presidential primary. And later on say that they describe themselves as an evangelical or born-again Christian. So their identity is politicized and religious. But let me explain the others, because I think it's the others who aren't showing up who are more likely to like Ted Cruz, but they're not showing up. In polls, if we want to do a good job of measuring evangelicals, we actually ask three questions. We ask whether or not they consider themselves an evangelical or born-again Christian. We ask about whether they've proselytized, have you witnessed in the last year about your faith, and ask whether or not they think the Bible is a literal word of God without error. And so if they say yes to all three of those, which is a stricter definition, we'll technically have fewer people identified, a whole lot of blacks who would be identified as evangelicals under that, but because they vote 90%+ Democratic, they're not talked about as the evangelical vote. But the people who are described as evangelicals in political polls have already shown up as politicized, and then they say they're evangelical. It's secondary. So the people who are amenable to Ted Cruz's evangelical message, to Ted Cruz's father, an evangelical minister, they're the evangelicals who say, I'm not of this world, and they don't bother voting.
But his is an evangelical message. And you say that for South Carolina voters, Dr. Huffman, their big issues are abortion, same-sex marriage, and religious freedom. Did those issues even come up with Donald Trump on the stump? Did he talk about any of those things?
He did. I think he talked about – well, if you define religious liberty in a broad sense, he's – I mean, and he puts it maybe in an inelegant way, but he said, when I'm president, we'll say Merry Christmas everywhere, because I think there's
– that's shorthand for religious freedom?
Well, I think so. I think
– how religious freedom is being defined by this.
How the culture – they feel the culture is going in a different direction and they want to push back on that. That's, I think, an example.
And Dr. Olson, you believe that abortion, more than same-sex marriage, is going to be the hot-button issue in the general election. Why?
I think it has the potential to be. I don't necessarily think that it will be. It's more likely that we'll hear about abortion than same-sex marriage because, I've been saying this for many years, that the boat has left the dock and it isn't coming back with regard to same-sex marriage. Younger voters in particular, we see a big generational sort of effect in public opinion about same-sex marriage, and younger voters are large majorities for same-sex marriage. And so that is, unless you're talking to a group of very conservative older folks and you want to use that as a little bit of red meat if you're the Republican nominee, it's really not going to get you a whole lot of purchase. But I wanted to add one other thing, too, about who an evangelical is. Scott and Tim are both 100% right that we have to be particular, right? And in the kind of work I do, you have to be really, really particular about what we mean by evangelicals. And just saying you're born again is a very blunt instrument when it's nicer to work with a scalpel. But in an exit poll, you've only got so much space. One thing that I think we're going to end up seeing is that not only is it blue-collar evangelicals who are supporting Trump, I think there's also going to be a powerful effect, and Scott alluded to this, of frequency of worship attendance. If you're not, there's a lot of diversity within the evangelical community. They comprise at least a quarter of the American population, and that doesn't include African-American evangelicals. And so there's going to be other things besides just saying I'm born again that are going to end up shaking out as important predictors of support for Trump.
So here's what we've been hearing from listeners on social media about this topic, at Charlotte Talks on Twitter, at WFAE on Facebook, Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org from email. Bill from Matthews, could it be something as simple as Trump saying what the masses want to hear, that America can have a bright future while the other conservative candidates are preaching about America going to hell in a handbasket? There has been a lot of that talk, hasn't there?
Well, I think Donald Trump's done his share of the sort of negative and fear.
But he's turning it around. He's saying things are crap now, but perhaps elect me and we'll be the greatest thing that ever since sliced bread. That's what he's saying.
Maybe.
Maybe? He said it a thousand
times.
Well, it's, I think the degree to which that comment is right is yes. Donald Trump is adding something new, that we will make America great again. But everybody, including Trump, is saying, America's horrible right now. It's just utterly terrible. And so he's capitalizing on that. Maybe he's doing a better job of adding that additional, but it'll all be hugely special and awesome.
Yeah, the implication is it's not great now. Why is it not great now? Well, because according to him, our borders are porous. ISIS is going after us. We're not effective overseas. We're not, it's the same thing you hear with a lot of Republicans. It just put a Trump spin on it.
We'll come back to that in a second. Now, Mark on Twitter, if the GOP was an airplane, we'd be all putting on parachutes right about now. Warren on Facebook, how can Trump be considered successful? He's had four bankruptcies of his businesses. Can somebody please explain how running a casino and licensing your name out for buildings makes you qualified to run a country? I don't think anybody at this table is qualified to answer that question. Steve on Facebook, the rise of Donald Trump within the Republican Party is just evidence of the cynical and racist Southern strategy started by Richard Nixon, finally tearing the party apart. Those who are left supporting these anti-gay, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim policies are evangelicals in name only. They are more accurately described as old-school fundamentalists led by people like Franklin Graham and Jerry Falwell Jr., who we will talk about later, who do not represent mainstream evangelicalism anymore. Is what we're witnessing a battle for the heart and soul and survival of the Republican Party?
Absolutely, yes. And to that last comment, that's a very insightful point about the parallel with Nixon. One thing I saw yesterday was some pictures of a Trump rally in Georgia, and the sign said, "The silent majority for Trump." And I thought, oh, that's absolutely right, right? So this is sort of what's left of Nixon's silent majority. To a certain degree, I think Trump is also trying to be Reagan 2.0 in the sense that there's this perception of American weakness after a Democratic president, and I come in and I speak kind of in generalities if I'm Trump and promise that things will be better, but in a very non-specific kind of way. But with regard to the party, most definitely yes. If there's this big rejection of anything that smacks of establishmentarianism, rejection of even Cruz, right, because he's been in the Senate for a little while, right, even if he's contrarian in the Senate, is there some danger that the party will come out of this looking quite different, perhaps even quite smaller? I think there is.
But there's also a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party this year, I think. I mean, I think both parties are in a state of where are we going to end up? I mean, one's going to the right, one's going to the left.
But if people...
There's no middle.
If people are upset because the country can't seem to move forward, and we can't seem to move forward because we have a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, and they don't talk to each other because it's a sin now to talk to each other, otherwise you'll get voted out of office, how do they expect that a Donald Trump, an outsider president, can work with an insider Congress? Won't they stop him every step of the way if they choose to?
No, they'll just learn from his brilliance and be able to go on. You know, you got to remember.
Are you doing that tongue in cheek, or are you being serious?
Tongue in cheek.
Okay, just checking.
But the belief is he'll bring something new. He's a negotiator. He knows how to negotiate with the hardest people in the world, so Congress will be no problem. I want to go back to something Dr. Olson said about the Nixon strategy and leading to this strategy with evangelicals, because Kevin Phillips, who is the author of The Southern Strategy for Richard Nixon, actually came out with a book during George W. Bush's administration called American Theocracy, where he warned of the danger of overly inserting religiosity into this. So this is the guy who came up with that Southern strategy, is decrying the idea of using not race but religion to carve out the South.
So South Carolina voters seem to be mirroring the anger and frustration that we see around the country among a lot of voters. And I'm just curious of what South Carolina voters are angry and frustrated about. They have a Republican-controlled Congress. They have a South Carolina legislature that is Republican. They have a Tea Party Republican governor. Republican voters are angry. So what needs to alleviate, what has to happen to alleviate that anger if Republicans are in charge of everything? And they kind of are.
In South Carolina, the view is sort of reversed from reality, because overall, for example, the economy is doing better nationally than the South Carolina economy. South Carolina economy is doing good, but it still slightly lags. Actual perception in South Carolina, especially among white voters, is the exact opposite. White voters see the South Carolina economy as doing much better than the national economy, and so they give credit to that to the Republicans in South Carolina who run things and wonder why can't things be this great nationally. They also feel pushed in because of those cultural things. It's sort of a a misreading. I've heard quite a few Tea Party folks talk about how, you know, all these things that you can't say Merry Christmas and you have to sell cakes to gay people is sort of like 1984 and Big Brother and Newspeak. And the reality is the exact opposite. It's true. The government's the only one that protects you. You don't have to say Merry Christmas. It's actually capitalism saying, ooh, we don't want to lose money, so we won't say Merry Christmas. The government protects your ability to do that, but that's not how it's perceived.
Why?
Perception. Why is it not perceived that way?
Yeah.
Because it seems like it's an imposition from culture telling you what you can't say. And as soon as somebody says you can't say this, people start incorrectly screaming First Amendment.
If the culture is changing, and apparently it is, can a government, a democratic government, stop it?
Change the culture? Well,
or stop the culture from changing?
I don't think the Democratic Party wants to. The Republican
no,
Party.
No, no, no. I don't mean Democratic Party. I mean, can a democratically elected government stop it?
Well, I think that you talk to Trump voters. I think they're angry at the Republican Party. They feel like they've elected these people to go to Washington, and things are changing anyway. I don't know. I mean, you know, people can't just press a button in Washington and say the Supreme Court ruling doesn't matter anymore.
So this anger will continue no matter who's elected.
Well, I think they want to elect a whole new group of Republicans,
yeah,
like Donald Trump, who will blow things up and start over again.
Dr. Olson.
The fact is that I think voters, and I hate that this is true, but it is, a lot of voters simply don't understand how the system works, right? They don't understand.
Why is that? Because you're right. They don't understand how it works. And I just that we have 8 years, more, 12 years of free public education. Are we not teaching government in schools anymore? And if not, why
lot,
not?
Right. I mean, part of it is lack of civics education, and part of it is in this day and age with the internet and with the 1,000 different channels that you can get your news from, whether on TV, whether online, whether wherever, you opt into sources of information that reinforce your view. And those sources of information largely are for-profit corporations that want to sell advertising time. And so it isn't important to say, well, okay, here's the boring facts of how a bill becomes a law.
So
here's the sort of nature of checks and balances, separation of powers, et cetera, and the necessity for compromise. People aren't as interested, of course, in that, because it's boring.
So once again,
as they are in sort of the drama of, oh, okay, the Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives is saying no to Obama, and isn't that exciting, right? And it's breaking news and red all over the screen and this sort of thing. And so no matter who becomes the next president, if Trump becomes the next president, it could be the case that the Democrats end up getting the Senate back. People are bound to end up being disappointed no matter what, because presidential candidates make all kinds of promises, right? We're going to build a wall with Mexico, or we're going to have free college education for everyone, or whatever the promise is. The average voter has no comprehension of the fact that, you know, if you're going to do these things, you've got to convince Congress to help you do them.
So what I'm hearing is, once again, in the last 5 minutes, the word capitalism has reared its ugly head. Capitalism is the boogeyman here, and yet voters want to elect the king of capitalism to fix the problem.
Well, it's only the boogeyman for half of the population at this point. I want to go back, though, talking about why we don't teach it. We do teach it. Mike, you learned about it in school. Tim learned about it. I learned
about
it.
That was the Pleistocene age, though.
But the students talk about it. You learned about it. You know what? You also learned chemistry. Can you explain ionization?
No.
Okay. So just because we learn these things, they are often put aside if they're not what we're passionate about.
Yeah,
so
but
stop blaming the kids.
But we live in a democratic republic. It seems to me that's part of our genetic makeup as opposed to ionization
and
chemistry.
For your listeners, but
we have to stop. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Hendrick Automall, Concord Mills, committed to customer service satisfaction and bringing excellence to the car buying experience, featuring 11 brands and over 3,000 vehicles at the Concord Mills location. Details at Hendrick Automall, ConcordMills.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting The Book of Mormon, the Broadway musical from the creators of South Park, tomorrow through March 6th at Belk Theater. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. Republican primary voters go to the polls in South Carolina. You may have noticed that. We've been talking about it for the last 40 minutes or so. While Democrats vote in the Nevada caucuses, analysis of the results and what they mean for the presidential candidates heading into Super Tuesday, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show. Join ours now at WFAE.org at Charlotte Talks, or you can reach us through Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go and throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue
and breakthrough moments.
Just let it sink in. An African-American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
All Things Considered weekday afternoons beginning at 4 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about evangelicals and their influence in the South Carolina primary and extrapolating that out into the general election at large as the election season goes on with Dr. Scott Huffman, political science professor at Winthrop University and director of the Winthrop Poll, Dr. Laura Olson, professor of political science at Clemson University, and Tim Funk, faith and values reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Conservative Justice Antonin Scalia died the Saturday before, or the weekend before, the South Carolina primary. He was one of the most conservative members of the Supreme Court, and his passing opens the door for a president to appoint a successor. If Obama can do that, that remains to be seen, given the Republican Senate. But this points out one of the key things that presidents do and have power over, and something that lasts long after their administration has faded away. That is influencing the makeup of the highest court in the land. How's that playing out in the evangelical Christian right community?
Well, I think Scalia was a hero to that community, and I think that they probably agree with they don't like Mitch McConnell, but they probably agree with him that the next president should pick the next Supreme Court justice. Now, that next president could be Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, but they're betting that a Republican will win. And I think, I mean, I agree with
that. But isn't that unconstitutional? If you're going to follow the precepts of the Constitution, of which Antonin Scalia was an ardent defender, it would say the president appoints with the advice and consent of the Senate. Mm-hmm. Let the president do that.
It doesn't force them to do it within a specific time frame. There's nothing in the Constitution specifically that says, since it happened on this president's watch, it must be done in a few months immediately. So there's
– I don't think it's going to happen. I think – but it's going to happen in the new year because they're not going to let a vacancy last for years and years. So I think it does matter who you vote for. I mean, I agree that that a lot of people don't understand the process. In the Democratic Party, too, there's a lot of anger about Obama because he can't push a button here or there and change everything. But look at the Reagan administration, look at the Obama administration. There's clearly a difference of not only the Supreme Court, but different policies and different the country. You know, this. So I do agree that we need to all learn more about how the system works. There's a lot of gridlock now. There's no middle. But it does matter who you vote for, and I think that's what's at stake, the Supreme Court and a lot of other things.
Here's what people are saying to us on Facebook, Twitter, and email. Steve on Facebook, Ted Cruz is a Dominionist Pentecostal, which is a very specific strand of evangelicalism, not exactly mainstream. Renee in Concord, Mike, please don't discount the large number of white Christian voters who vote Democratic. The Christian left has a huge voice, and Trump and Cruz are anathema to our beliefs. While some blog sites are backing Sanders, and I like some of his ideas too, I'm personally backing Clinton. Check out The Christian Left on Facebook. Let's talk about the Christian right, however, for a second.
Well, we are talking mainly about the Republican primary,
yes,
and of course, Christians on the left are probably going to vote in the Democratic.
In the Democratic primary. So, Dr. Olson, you say that the top-down structure of the religious right or the evangelical movement has disappeared and become more locally focused, and that has changed the way a lot of evangelicals see themselves. Explain that.
That's right. Well, when evangelical Protestants first became politically active after a long period of disengagement from politics around the beginning of the 1980s, right around the time that Reagan was elected, There was a great deal of kind of lack of know-how in terms of political strategy, in terms of political lobbying, in terms of thinking about how to accomplish any kind of policy priorities. So at that point in time, you needed strong leadership at the top, and that came in the form of Jerry Falwell Sr., and then later Pat Robertson. After the movement had been around for 10, 15 years, it not only grew, the Christian right movement, that is, it also became more sort of locally specialized, because folks who really didn't maybe know what they were doing in terms of who to go talk to try and accomplish policy priorities found out that, oh, you know, a lot of the issues we care about are actually state and local issues. And so the movement gets diversified, right, as it spreads and it looks differently in different states. And with that comes kind of the disappearance of a need for a strong hand at the top of the movement, because it's doing its own thing in different regions. As a result, right now, there is a lack of sort of national level leadership, and there's also been an influx of, because evangelical Protestantism has grown, white evangelical Protestantism has grown, you necessarily have more diversity in that population, and younger evangelicals are, a lot of them, saying, you know, I don't really like the old culture wars, sexuality kinds of issues that my grandfather's Christian right maybe supported. I'd rather go a different way. I might be interested in poverty, this, that, and the other. And so what you have is a so-called army, I suppose, that is a lot more difficult to lead than it would have been, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
So millennials now, I think, equal in number the baby boom generation, and they do have a different outlook on a lot of things. They have gay friends. They many of them want to help the poor. Many of them believe in climate change. Can we look to millennial and millennial churches, like, and I guess you would call Elevation Church in Charlotte a millennial church, and get some clues on their impact on this election?
Well, that's incredibly complicated. I will tell you, I'll start off by saying, if you want evidence of what Laura's saying, all you have to do is look at how evangelicals have localized and gone after school boards for the past 10 years and gotten elected to school boards. They focused on local issues, and you can see that as evidence everywhere. As far as millennials go, millennials now have surpassed the baby boomers in size of population. They don't vote in nearly the numbers. They are describing themselves as spiritual but not religious. In fact, they described their, when they respond to surveys, their spirituality across several, I think three questions, which Pew uses to measure it, is as high as any other generation, but they are eschewing organized religion in larger numbers because of the very thing that you just said. It seems old-fashioned. It seems focused on the wrong things. And so we are seeing evangelical churches trying to reach out to these groups with non-traditional worship. We see it in South Carolina with New Spring. We see it in, well, everywhere with, you know, Elevation as well. You know, the degree to which they're successful is really, we're really not that certain yet. Millennials, again, are less religious doesn't mean they're less spiritual. But how they're going to focus that into politics, the parties are going to have to change, especially the Republican Party, because they aren't as angry about those social issues that you mentioned, and they want change on different things. They are going to have to change their appeal to reach them.
You write about this.
Well, it's interesting. Even Elevation Churches gets 17,000, 20,000 people every weekend, and a lot of those are millennials. And it's interesting to me that Stephen Furtick, the pastor, didn't say much about Amendment 1, for example, when that was coming. This is Southern Baptist Church. They don't advertise that, but a lot of Southern Baptist churches were on the bandwagon trying to pass the ban on same-sex marriage, and they don't, at Elevation, really don't get involved in those kind of divisive issues that much. I think they focus more on personal spirituality. To get back to what you said about local, it's interesting. Franklin Graham's going around the country right now to try to mobilize Christian voters, but one of his biggest lines is that I want you to run for office too, and I want you to run for school board. Wouldn't it be great if all the school boards in the United States were run, were you know, were controlled, I guess is my word, by born-again Christians. I mean, I think – and he's become – Franklin has become involved in the debate here about the LGBT civil rights issues. So it's on all levels here, I think, that these people are getting involved in.
Well, although his father, Billy Graham, it has been argued, never got involved in politics. He certainly had a lot of friends who were highly placed in politics, particularly in the Oval Office. But Franklin Graham says he's not going to get he's not going to tell people who to vote for simply to exercise biblical principles in making their decision. He says he thinks both parties are corrupt, that our system is corrupt. A lot of people feel that way. Is that the most important takeaway, that the influence of money on politics, the increasing amount of wealth shifting to fewer and fewer people, the stagnation of the middle class, and the lowering of standards of living as a result of all that is something that Washington is going to have to address in some way, both parties, and quickly?
In terms of Franklin, though, I think he's not going to endorse anybody in the primaries, I think. But what's going to happen in the fall, you're going to have a Democrat versus a Republican, and he is going to be, in effect, mobilizing Christian voters. He's telling them to vote for their biblical principles and godly leaders. So the Republican candidate for president is going to sound an awful lot like Franklin Graham. He's not going to endorse that candidate, but it's all about turnout anymore, and he's going to get a lot of Christians, he hopes, to the polls. And he's coming to Raleigh in October, I think, to do his prayer rally on the steps of the Capitol, about the same time that Pat McCrory, who's close to the Graham family, might need a little boost in his reelection campaign. So he is not endorsing anyone, but he is a politically savvy religious leader.
Dr. Olson.
Any clergy person who formally endorses a candidate can lose the tax-exempt status of any organization he or she leads in a hurry, and they know that. So there are ways of sort of getting around that, just like Tim was saying. Go vote your values, right, this idea, and that's what drove George W. Bush's reelection campaign in 2004, not saying outwardly, go vote for Bush, but very strongly hinting at it. So Franklin, that's absolutely right. Franklin Graham isn't going to necessarily come out and endorse someone by name, but he and various other religious leaders across the country will strongly imply it. And I wanted to say something real quickly, too, about the Christian left, because of the person who commented on that online. One thing to know about the Democratic Party and the degree to which it is able to, strategically speaking, reach out to people of faith, it's complicated on that side, much, much more than it is on the Republican side, because secular Americans, a sector that's growing and growing faster than any other in terms of religious affiliation, is heavily Democratic. And so you don't want to sort of throw sort of religious lingo out there in a way that might drive away secular voters. So it becomes a lot more complicated to use religious language and rhetoric on the trail for a Democrat than it does for a Republican.
But you look at Moral Monday here in Raleigh, and it's led by a minister, an African-American minister, and there's a lot of quotes from Jesus about taking care of the poor. So Christianity is not a monolith, and there's all kinds of Christian voters, and they emphasize different parts of the Bible and different issues. So that's parts of what's
going on. Talk about Jerry Falwell Jr. for a second, because despite his declared intention of not becoming political like his father was, and Jerry Falwell Jr. is an attorney, I don't think he's involved in the church aspect of
President of Liberty.
Okay. But he's declared his support for Donald Trump, and he did so prior to the Iowa caucuses, which raised a lot of eyebrows. Why did he do that, and how influential is his support likely to be, or does Donald Trump even need his support at this point?
Well, I think it helped him. I think he compared Donald Trump to his father, and he compared Jerry Falwell, who also said a lot of things that unsettled people. And he compared himself to his father in that his father endorsed Ronald Reagan, who at the time some people thought, well, this guy's been divorced, he's an actor. But I think Jerry Falwell Jr. agrees that, with a lot of other supporters of Trump, that this is a guy that can get it done.
Yeah.
Don't look at his personal life. We've gone that route before. It hasn't worked. Let's go with somebody that's a quote leader.
I don't think it's gonna sway many folks, but the folks who are Christian and wanting to be behind Trump, this will give him some legitimacy. A lot of what we're seeing on the use of this rhetoric by the Republican Party to bring in evangelicals and bring in Christians is actually echoes what happened in the 30s, 40s, and culminated in the 50s. The National Association of Manufacturers, the huge business conglomerates, actually started backing some ministers who would put out nationwide pamphlets and pushed prayer breakfast for business leaders and politicians, culminating in the National Prayer Breakfast and pushing Eisenhower, who was baptized once he was in office. He was raised in this weird Christian environment, but he wasn't baptized until later. And he, they get under God, put in the pledge. They get, "In God We Trust" is the motto. And so we're seeing conservatives in America who were really upset with what they saw as, a godless communist or socialist approach under FDR, organizing and using religion as the avenue to fight that. And we're seeing a mentality like that now, I think.
And it was during that period that a young minister named Billy Graham emerged as this sort of...
Let me ask a naive question, and it kind of dovetails with what you just talked about. Former Republican South Carolina Governor David Beasley said that voters are concerned and worried, and they don't see, this is a quote, they don't see Washington fixing it. In fact, they see big government and big business having too much influence in ways that are not solving the problem. So many voters don't like establishment politicians, which accounts for the exit of Jeb Bush. But if they distrust big business, why vote for a big businessman like Donald Trump? So why not switch over to Bernie Sanders, who rails against both big business and the government?
Right, but the party of big government is just identified ever since FDR as the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party, while they're pro-business, they are also the party of small government, allegedly. So people are saying, okay, the national government can't fix anything, so how about a little Margaret Thatcher-esque devolution of power back to the states?
Is there any candidate in either party who can effectively address these issues from the White House? Very quickly, Dr. Olson, 10 seconds.
No.
Well, the voice of doom and gloom gets the last word. Dr. Laura Olson, professor of political science at Clemson University. Tim Funk, faith and values reporter for the Charlotte Observer, also reporting on politics now. And Dr. Scott Huffman, professor of political science and the director of the Winthrop Poll at Winthrop University. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte?